I am here with Mr. Fred Leverant. It is November 16th, 2006, and we will be talking about his experience as a POW during World War II. Mr. Leverant, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Leverant.
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 Before we get into your experiences in the camp,
yes.
Can you briefly describe your participation in the war itself?
Yes, I was just a common infantryman with the Lincoln and Welland Regiment, which was formed part of a brigade of the 4th Armored Division. And we were tasked to fight under Montgomery. This is my last action, that is, to take all the area north and west of Amsterdam to secure the ports of Amsterdam, being that our supply line from France by this time was far too long.
So where were you captured?
I was captured right on the border of Belgium and Holland, just outside a town called Eschen, E-S-S-C-H-E-N.
What circumstances were you captured under?
Well, it was just simply an infantry attack that we made to take pressure off the Argyll's and Sutherland Highland regiments, one of our sister regiments in the brigade. And we simply bit off more than we could chew, and our casualties were appalling that day. And 12 of us attacked too far, and we were captured.
Were you injured at all?
I was wounded.
Whereabouts?
On the left side, shrapnel.
Okay. How were you treated for that, right at your capture?
Very well.
Mm-hmm. By doctors? What kind of medical assistance?
Well, first of all, I was patched right up on the at their regimental headquarters. And then we were sent for interrogation. And the next morning, I was taken by a German-type jeep to a field hospital in Holland. And there, I was the only Allied soldier in the hospital, which made me feel very, very uneasy. With all the suffering and screaming that was going on, I more or less felt responsible for it. But in no way did they take any umbrage with me at all. And they treated me very well. As a matter of fact, after I had been operated on, that morning I was given the best meal I'd had since I left Canada.
How did this compare to the treatment you would receive in camp?
In our own?
In the prisoner of war camp.
Oh, well, I think you have to understand that our treatment in the prison camp was very, let's say, Spartan. It's kind of an understatement. But it was not a policy. It was just a matter of logistics. They didn't have it. They didn't have the fuel. We went without fuel in our buildings all winter. It was building the cold. And we didn't have enough food. We were on starvation rations. And medical supplies were very limited. We had paper bandages, this sort of thing. And very few medicines. But it was, as I say, it was not a matter of national policy. It was. They were very short themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now that we're into the camp, can you just describe to me the layout of the camp? Or what?
Yes, I think perhaps you did indicate that you were interested in the structure, in the command.
Yes.
All right. Now, first of all, each arm of the service looked after their own prisoners. The Army looked after Army, vice versa. Air Force mm-hmm. looked after the Air Force and the Navy, and so on. So if you were if you were Army, you went to a stalag. I went to Starlag 11B, which was up near in the Lunenburger Heide area, the northern part of Germany. And my Air Force comrades here in Victoria, they were all what they call a Stalag Luft Air Force. And the Navy went to a Marlag, Marine type. And that's how they worked it. And in the Stalag, they consisted of groups of huts, big, long, single-story frame buildings, very much very elongated. And I suppose initially they were meant to hold perhaps 80 people, I suppose. But of course we were so overcrowded. And then our camp, called our lager, was adjacent to us. There were other lagers. Right adjacent to us was the Russians. And then you would have maybe another one with Poles. And so that's how they ran it.
Okay. What would your daily routine be like in camp?
Yes. 6 o'clock, roll call. We go outside for roll call. And then you would they'd come around with a large can, like I say, about a 30-gallon drum. Mm-hmm. And they'd bring that around with ersatz coffee. You'd have a cup of that. It was barley, roasted barley, was what it was. It was hot. It wasn't very much like coffee, but we were glad of it. And we didn't get fed at all until about 5 o'clock in the evening, when we got a bowl of soup and quite often 2 boiled potatoes and a ration of bread, just a thick slice of bread. And that's where your rations. And then about after December, about January, early January, there was around probably, I don't know, 6 to 10,000 people, fellows in our camp, in our lager. They consisted of Canadians, British, and American. They emptied the Canadians out of the camp. They took us all out, which there were about 250 of us. And they loaded us into trucks. And they took us to further north, northwest, a place I can't even put it on a map. There's no town near it or anything. And it was a camp out in the woods. Very pretty place. And we worked in the salt mines.
Because you were a non-commissioned officer.
Because I was a private.
Yeah, private. You had to work. So how was the command set? How was the command structure of camp set up? You were controlled by the army, but who gave the orders?
There was probably a full colonel in charge of the camp. But we had our own command structure,
yes,
too. We had an RSM, Regimental Sergeant Major,
okay,
from the airborne, the paratroops. And they were captured at Arnhem. As a matter of fact, the Arnhem chaps, British paratroops, they staffed the hospital, and they pretty well ran the camp. And the RSM Lord, a very famous man, very distinguished, and he was given the George Medal for his work that he did in the camp. He kept the camp, kept the morale of the camp. We were all always smartly dressed because of him. And he more or less instilled in us the fact that we were still British or Canadian soldiers, and he was in charge.
Mm-hmm. how did he enter? Was he the highest ranking of all of you, or
yes.
was he elected?
No, he was the highest ranking. Okay. He stayed on, volunteered mm-hmm. to stay on.
So he was there because of his rank, not necessarily because of his capability. Oh, he stayed instead of going to the officer?
He volunteered to stay on.
Okay.
Yes.
That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Who was selected to fill specific positions, and who appointed them, say, like, the cook or something?
Oh, well, the Germans had slave laborers, French, Polish, whatnot, did all the cooking and things mm-hmm. like that.
Okay, but say, would you have different commanders for each different bunkhouse? Or would there be, like, a person in charge of each house?
No, I don't think that we had anyone in... I don't recall having anyone in charge in each bunkhouse.
Okay.
No.
So was there any... So this RSM major, he was that the head. He controlled the camp. Did he have a?
He had some NCOs.
Like
yes, he had. He had. There were a few staff sergeants that had stayed by. I remember there were glider pilots, most of them, and they stayed behind, and they were. They were in charge as well.
Mm-hmm. So they
under,
also
under him.
They also were chosen because of their rank.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. They volunteered to stay behind.
Yeah, that's very. That's mm-hmm. different from other things I've, from other experiences I've heard. How much was he under the control of the German captors? Was he?
Oh, completely.
Yes.
Completely. But they gave him. They allowed him. To retain that authority, they thought that was a good idea because it assisted them too.
Mm-hmm. So they didn't have anyone of their own that they put in place over top of you. It was your own command.
Only, as I say, they would come in for various reasons, for inspections. They'd clear everyone out of the hut and tear everything apart. And they would every day. Of course, they were in charge of the roll call. They did the counting. And we had roll call twice a day, once in the morning, once in the late afternoon. They were dreadful things during the winter time. We were ill clothed. A lot of people didn't have hats. Some even didn't even have greatcoats. And it was the coldest winter on record that year, 44, 45. And those roll calls. They went on and on and on, and if they miscount, it was awful. You would stand there freezing. You know. I was wearing, by this time, I was wearing a pair of clogs, wooden clogs. And for socks, I had what they call foot flappers, just a sheet of flannel in which you wrapped around your feet, put them in the clogs. You can imagine how slippery they were on ice. And... I had a gray coat. I was lucky. I didn't have a hat. Yes, I did. I had a French hat. A soft French hat. You know. But, you know, you had no scarf. You had no muffler or gloves or anything like that. And so it was a pretty terrible getting through that winter.
The clothes you did have, who provided them? Your French hat?
The cap. They had.
Was there any sort of informal... power structures, they, I'm not sure, I haven't run into any other experiences of, say, a small black market or something, someone who unofficially...
Black market?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, everybody was involved in it. If you had anything to flog, the term was flogging.
Okay.
If you had anything to flog, yes, well, you went to see how much... There was a price structure. 20 cigarettes would get you a loaf of bread. Cigarettes were the medium of exchange.
Mm-hmm. And you get those in your Red Cross packages?
We did. Or sometimes people would receive them by mail, too.
Okay.
Mail from home.
So you still receive mail from mm-hmm. loved ones.
Yeah.
And whatnot. I've heard of something called schools, wherein groups of men would join together and share everything equally that they received from home or from the Red Cross packages. Did this at all exist in your camp?
Yes, we all did that. You shared things, and so you could make a soup or something like that with what you had. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How formal was it in the camp, such as saluting or...
You saluted German officers. Mm-hmm. They were the only officers we saw around there.
What about your RS?
No, he doesn't. He's not entitled to a salute.
Okay. So you didn't have to do that?
Actually. No. But you certainly stood to attention to him when you spoke to him.
Okay. were there any other ways you kind of tried to keep the feeling of being in the air or being in the active duty alive?
We didn't really try to do very much except get through every day as best we could. You have to remember, we were starving. Mm-hmm. And that's about the, when a person's hungry, that's about the only thing you can think about. And getting out.
Yeah.
You know, either escaping or just hoping for liberation.
Were there any escape attempts made at your camp?
Not, I think there must have been. But not in my time, not in the big camp. It was very difficult because there were a lot of camps around there and there were a lot of military training camps around there. So getting away was pretty difficult. Mm-hmm. I did manage to escape from the salt mines.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Would you mind telling me about that?
No, I don't mind telling you. It wasn't very difficult because of the stage that the Germany was at. It was getting towards the end of the war. I got away in April 1945, and the war ended in May. The reason I decided to escape was because we were warned that we were going to go, to be prepared to go on the march. Have you ever heard of the march?
The death marches.
Yes, they call them death marches because in the winter time, particularly the fellows died of malnutrition and, of course, the cold. And if they couldn't keep up, sometimes they were shot. So I had no intention of going on one of those if I could avoid it. So another chap and I got away from the Stalag. We were out on a wood party, and we had arranged with the others that we would get away. And they cooperated, and we did make our... And we were gone... We were only gone 3 days, 2 nights, and we met up with the Allies. So
they're closing in on your position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So obviously you knew where you were, and you knew which direction to escape to.
We, just a general idea, we had no map, no compass, no food. We were pretty weak before we left even. But we knew that where the Allies were generally in a westerly, southwesterly direction, and that's the way we headed, okay. Using the star at night and whatnot. And,
mm-hmm. Aside from the rumors circulating, how did, and the decreased rations, was there anything else change in the camp as victory approached?
Nothing visible, no.
Okay. Just a general morale boost?
Well, you have to know, too, that we could tell that things were getting towards the end because of the amount of air raids and things like that. But that's the only thing. We had no news given to us at all. They suppressed anything that they could. They wouldn't give you any news at all. And any news that they did give you was all biased.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a general idea.
Right. Yeah. How did that biased news affect you on propaganda? Did it at all influence anyone within the camp?
Well, let's take it at Christmas 1944. The Germans made the big push going through the Ardennes,
mm-hmm.
and the Battle of the Bulge. And of course, the news that we got then was the war was just about over in their favor, you know. And right up till then, we were looking for perhaps to be liberated by then. Mm. Our morale really took a plunge. And instead of the Americans liberating us, they came into the camp, and there were no rations for them, so each two of us would take one American and share our rations with them for about 10 days until they could get rations for them.
Okay.
So it was a pretty grim, and they were in bad shape.
Yeah. One thing I've been speaking with my other veterans is, I don't think this applies much to you because of the shorter period of time you were captured, mm-hmm. but the things that were that kept them alive, such as their hope or faith in something, kept them going. How did a sense of hope or even faith help you while you were there?
Well, as you say, I was only in there 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those chaps were in there 5 years. I can't imagine being in there for 5 years. That's 6 months is plenty.
Mm-hmm.
That problem didn't
exist for you?
Didn't exist, really.
From what you observed with any others, could you get an idea of how it was with them?
Damn disconcerting to be in there all that time. I think they probably thought they would never get out of there. And that was the worst part about being in the prison. You could always put up with the difficulties because we were young, very, very flexible. But mentally, when they made that push into the Ardennes, we had no idea how long we were going to be prisoners, and that was the worst part. I think that you might never get out of there. Because if they had won, we never would have gone home again. Not likely, anyway.
No. What ways did you kind of passively resist the German forces?
Well, we didn't work very hard in the mines. We used to cut off. There was the mines were very extensive. They were very far down, and to our level where we worked, there were different various levels. And we had the tunnels. It was a salt mine and hard rock salt. And digging there, they didn't have to have any forms, any columns or any beams or anything. They just had to hollow it out, and it was just a natural tunnels. And alongside the wall, along the walls, they had cable for providing lighting. Well, we used to sometimes get in there and cut out the lighting, and we'd be there for an hour sitting in the dark, pitch dark, and we would sleep until I got it. And you know, there were never any reprisals. Never any reprisals. We would do it so that it didn't look like it was. We wouldn't tear anything, but loosen it up. We were never bullied, except by some of the Polish foremen. They would have pressure put upon them, you know, and they would put the pressure on us. They never bullied us. And there were men who lived down there who never saw the daylight unless for an hour on Sunday they went up to the top. And they were given a shower because there was no water facilities down there. And they were German political prisoners. A lot of them were professors and things like that at universities. And they had lived down there since Hitler came to power.
Yeah.
In that mine.
Yeah. What was that?
Yeah. They wore blue trousers with a yellow stripe, no shirts, just bare because it was warm down there. Heads shaved. Of course, our heads were shaved too. But, yeah.
Did you have much contact with them?
One man always came with the foreman, and he'd have carrying a lantern in case the power went out. And when I spoke to him, two or three times when he was around. And this one chap that I had, he had been a professor at one of the universities. I read in my book, but I can't remember which one. And very, very. Spoke very good English, very articulate. Yeah, and he'd been down there all that time. I don't imagine many of them are alive today.
From where you were in your camp, you were near, you say, Russian and Polish prisoners. How were they treated in comparison with you?
Worse. Right. The Russians didn't come under the Geneva Convention, and they starved. The winter before we were there, I understand there was 10,000 died of typhus, and they would just be hiding them under the floorboards so they could collect their rations, you know. Yeah. Come spring, it must have been terrible.
Did you have any contact with them at all?
Just through the wire. We couldn't. There were two wires.
Okay.
You couldn't reach them or anything.
But probably none of you spoke Russian. Probably very few of them spoke English.
No.
All right. Well, let's move back to when you your escape attempt and when you were picked up by the Allies. What was the process you went through? A debriefing.
Oh, debriefing?
Well,
yeah, that's right. Well, that was rather funny. We found them. They didn't find us. And they fed us. One of the chaps had a crate of eggs on the tank. And his tank was in a ditch. And when we told him who we were, he couldn't believe it, you know. All these skeletal apparitions come charging out of the bush at him. The one who didn't shoot us. And so he fried us up a couple of eggs and some bread, nearly killed us. And then they took us by jeep back to the...
And then I better shut this off for a second.
We were taken back to their regimental headquarters. Here's something interesting.
Mr. Levin is referring to a book he has written.
Yeah. This is a poster that was put up in every camp. And to all prisoners of war, the escape from prison camp is no longer a sport. And in it they tell you about death zones that are designated, but you don't know where they are. And they're generally... Is that on?
Yes. Yes.
They're generally around areas... like oil fields, any military installations or anything like that. And if you're caught on, they shoot you on sight. So escaping was rather dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But they posted that up in every camp, which didn't make you feel very nice when you're trying to escape. But anyway, we met up with the British... With the British Guards Armored Brigade, and they took us to their headquarters, and they locked. There's two of us. They locked Herbie and I up in a barn with another German officer, prisoner of war. And we thought this was rather odd, and we were taken in one at a time and interrogated. Not debrief, we were interrogated. And they came right off the bat talking to us in German, this one chap.
Really?
Yeah. So they might have had to make sure that we were who we purported to be. So then it didn't take very long before they realized that we were Canadians. And after that, it was fine. They relaxed. And then, of course, they gave us a shower, and they issued a new kit of clothing and whatnot. It was just marvelous. And toothbrush, everything. Identification. And then by truck, we took about, it must have taken us about 4 days, I guess, to drive back to Brussels. Each day we'd take a different truck or whatnot, whatever was available, and met to Brussels. And we flew from Brussels. We stayed in Brussels for a couple of nights, and then we went to... We flew back to Britain and then to England, and then from there we went back to our Canadian mm-hmm. organization.
Okay. How were you received there?
Oh, marvelous. They had camps. All the reinforcement camps that they had built were now turned into repatriation camps. And they looked at the experiences of the First World War, and everyone in that camp had been in action. Most of them were wearing wound stripes. Even the padre was wearing a wound stripe.
Okay.
Because they knew that if they put us in with zombies, we would have torn the camp to pieces. Do you know what zombies are?
No, I don't.
Okay.
No.
We had conscription during the war.
Yes.
And you could volunteer for the active army and go overseas and do the fighting, or you could say, I'm not going to go overseas.
Mm-hmm.
I won't go overseas. And this was to placate Quebec.
Okay.
And so they had something like 85,000 zombies in Canada,
so
sitting here on their butt. Well, supposedly training in case Canada was invaded.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
They didn't have to go. So we called them zombies. And but towards the end of the war, the government was pressured so strongly by the public, by the media and everything, to get these fellows overseas, because our holding units were empty.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't supply us enough, and these fellows were still sitting here. So they started sending them over. Now only a handful went over. But you can imagine what we would have done to them if they were running the camp where we were. So they made sure that everybody in the camp was an active serviceman. Yeah. But anyway, they couldn't do enough for us. It was just marvelous. They said that prisoners of war could not be made to work, do any extra duties or anything like that, guard duties or anything after that. We were finished. They're going to send us home and discharge us. Yeah.
A couple of questions I forgot to ask regarding back to your time in the mm-hmm. camp. What were some of the things you did for entertainment? I mean, you had all these hours of the day where you're doing nothing before you were sent to the mines.
There was an orchestra they had. Now, this only happened once. And they put on a show. And there was plays and skits and things like that, but that was only one time. And we had no cards, no books to read, anything like that. There was nothing.
So what did you do?
No letters. There was no paper for writing. No writing material. They would issue us one a month. It was a blue like an airmail.
Yeah.
And you could write on that and mail it.
Mm-hmm. So during the days you just have to sit and talk with...
There was nothing to do. You'd walk around the compound, walk. That's all you could do. Yeah.
And also, just kind of the bonds you formed there, are you still in touch with anyone who you were captured with?
Not that I was captured with, or anything like that, no. But we have a prisoner of war association here in
Victoria. Yes, I heard
you were
president of it, actually.
I was. I'm secretary permanently, so running the thing.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
So you keep in touch with other prisoners of war that way?
Oh, yes. Yes.
What about this Herbie man who you...
He's dead now.
He died?
Yeah. His son came to visit me.
Okay.
He lived in just outside Hamilton. Ontario, but he died. Unfortunately, I managed to find out where he lived. I guess it was probably from the computer. And when I contacted him, he died only the month before.
Really?
Yeah. All those years. Yeah. So.
No, I don't think I have many more questions. But thank you very much. You've been very helpful.
Well, not at all.
Questions.
If you think of anything that you want to, give me a phone call.
Okay.
I can help fill it in. There's so much happened, I wouldn't know where to start to tell you.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Shut this off.